This is Jim Engster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Nikki Papazoglikas. She ran fifth in the 2011 governor's election, and she's busy with something involving politics that we'll find out more from her about in short order. Also on the show, Smiley Anders, the venerable columnist from the Baton Rouge and now New Orleans Advocate. Smiley Anders will be here to talk about the closing of the Westmoreland Piccadilly and much more. The second Piccadilly in the chain closed Sunday after 55 years. And we have Ben Williams, LPB producer. He was there at the first day and last day of that establishment. Two fabulous novelists also on deck. Dean Koontz, his latest bestseller is The City, and Jane Ann Phillips. We'll talk with both of them, but first the news. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Busy show today, and we start with a lady who finished fifth in the 2011 governor's election, received 21,885 votes, and she is still intricately involved in politics, albeit in a different way. Good morning, Nikki Papazoglikas.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to talk with you. You have the most distinctive name in Louisiana, perhaps in American politics. And you ran for governor against Bobby Jindal. That must have been quite an experience.
It definitely was.
I don't think he debated you, though.
He did not.
No. So how's life been since 2011?
It's been great. The election actually really taught me, showed me a whole different side of the political process. I had done lobbying before and government contracting. I had done advocacy work, but seeing the system, you know, as a candidate kind of gives you a different perspective. And so I sort of took that knowledge and came up with an idea for a virtual town square to try to bring back the vision that our founding fathers had of the nation with a representative democracy where constituents are actually engaged in the political process and that our elected officials are able to represent constituent interests.
And how does this virtual town square work?
Well, if you think about kind of in your virtual world, Facebook is sort of your living room. LinkedIn is like the office. Twitter's the local pub. So Fregal, my company, will be the town square. So there's a social network front end that is a dedicated platform for civic and political engagement. Using a back end that collects all sorts of publicly available government information that's out there, but it's difficult to collect and make any sense out of, and we represent it in ways that are easy to understand and then provide a variety of engagement tools to assist.
So you're going to talk politics in this realm. Is that the plan?
I will not. Fregal as a platform is a nonpartisan, unbiased platform that will allow for very partisan discussion.
When I say you, I'm talking about the collective you.
Yes, yes.
I don't know why you wouldn't be part of that, but you'll have people presumably of all political stripes chiming in on the issues of the day.
Absolutely. Part of the goal is to get us away from, you know, an environment where politics has kind of been whittled down to, you know, 30-second attack ads and really bring back allow a forum to bring back some substantive dialogue in the debate.
All right. Is this a Nikki idea, or is it a Nikki idea in conjunction with a lot of other people? Will this be replicated in other places?
We definitely want to go nationally and, you know, eventually, hopefully globally. I do have partners. I developed the core idea and then have had a whole bunch of people along the way that have contributed.
Well, you have some people who have stepped forward to endorse this idea. I noticed Bob Mann being one of them. Obviously, political junkies are looking to feed their habit no matter how they can do it. And how will this be available to the general public?
Well, we are in the process right now. Next week, we are launching a crowdfunding campaign to raise the capital to complete product development. And it's called a freemium model, where it's free to the general public to subscribe. And then premium subscribers, such as politicians and advocacy organizations, would pay a subscription fee.
All right. So to find you, where do people go?
They go to freegle.com, freegle.com.
If you were up today, what would be the major issue you would be discussing today?
I think it depends. There would hopefully be a lot of forums and engagement. Obviously,
so
we're
talking multiple issues then.
Oh yes, absolutely. I mean, we're going into getting underway with an election cycle, so we hope to be a very instrumental tool to connect candidates with constituents, and also on issues, legislation that may be coming up.
Well, before we leave, I have an email. A listener asked if this is just another spot for Jindal haters to converge, since you ran against him.
No, that is absolutely not it. In fact, one of the differentiators between our platform and anything else that we've seen in this realm is that we do not allow anonymity on the platform. And so this, removing that veil of anonymity will hopefully bring some substance back into the dialogue
I get emails from people, and I have a feeling that on occasion some of these people are using fake names. That's why I always take calls ahead of, or you generally take calls ahead of emailers, because callers have to at least to let people hear their voices. How do you know they're telling the truth?
We do a user verification, user identification, similar to what you would do with an online banking system.
Okay, so this is state of the art.
Yes, very much
Freegle.
So.
Freegle.com, and the official rollout is when?
Well, we're launching the crowdfunding campaign on the Indiegogo platform this coming Monday, July 7th. We're also having a launch party at Huey's in downtown Baton Rouge from 5 to 8. The public is welcome.
On the 7th?
On the 7th.
A politico in there. The guy who owns the joint is the Metro Councilman, John Delgado.
Correct.
He gets in the news every now and then.
He does. He does. We figured that the theme of the bar being...
What did he compare the St. George proponents to Al-Qaeda? That might get things stimulated in an online environment.
That definitely could. Definitely could spark some interesting conversation.
Well, hopefully some of the St. George proponents will show up for your launch party, and there will be some fireworks at Huey's come Monday.
Well, let's not say literal fireworks, but yes, definitely. We invite everyone to come. Please support the effort. Our plan is to have the product completed by January to February of next year and be able to launch at that time, in time for the 2015 races.
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing from you, and hopefully there will be discussion about this program and others that are on WRKF at freegle.com, freegle.com. The official launch is Monday, and I didn't know you got a party to go with it at Huey's, named after a great Louisiana politico.
Exactly.
Owned by a guy who wants to be mayor of the city. Thank you very much. Nikki Papazoglakis.
Thank you, Jim.
And joining us now is a guy who did not change his name. He was born Smiley Gray Anders, November of 1937, in the great hamlet of Natchez, Mississippi. Good morning to you, Smiley Anders.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, a few weeks ago, you wrote a piece in The Advocate about the changes at Estruma High, and that's sad. And your class of 55, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, shortly after Smiley left Estruma, the Westmoreland Piccadilly opened, 1959. It was the second Piccadilly. And Sunday was the last day. Did you go to the final day?
No, I didn't. But I often went there. And it's really, really sad in a way, but still... You know, for an eating establishment to last 55 years is really kind of amazing, considering how many have come and gone in that amount of time.
Well, yeah, and in fact, I have some listeners saying that it was arguably the longest standing restaurant in one location in Baton Rouge. Has the Pastime been at its current location?
Pastime's over 60, I think.
At the same place? Or is it moved?
As I understand it, it started as a grocery store. They started serving sandwiches the Elises did, and then eventually became a bar. And
well, and Louie's, my regular eating place, does not count, because even though the sign says since 1941, it's been at its current location since 1986. So it should say since 1986.
Louie's Dutch Meal on Chimes.
Soon it should say since serving people since 2014, when it goes to the old Wendy's on Lake Street. But the Piccadilly on Westmoreland closed, and I mean in a flash.
Yeah, they didn't give us a lot of notice, and they said they had a huge crowd there for the last day, which is.
I went Sunday at about 2:30, and when I walked in, the lady at the piano was playing "Old Anxine," appropriately.
No kidding.
Yeah, and
that's
earlier, pretty... I understand Henry Gray was there, and he was regularly at the piano.
I would go there for liver and onions and Henry Gray. Yeah, right.
Smiley Anders, the columnist for 35 years, every morning, Section B, page one. Smiley Anders tells us what's happening through the eyes and words of his reading audience. And with us in studio as well is Ben Williams, producer for Louisiana Public Broadcasting. And Smiley, Ben was not only there Sunday... Ben was at the Westmoreland Piccadilly the day it opened in 1959.
That's what he was telling me. He said he was 5 years old.
He was there day one and day whatever. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
It's kind of sad, isn't it?
Well, things happen. There are other Piccadillys, but not like that one.
No. How was it in 1959?
Well, as a five-year-old, they had no hot food that day. It was just soft drinks and... dessert, pies, and cakes, and as far as I was concerned, it was heaven. I mean, how could it go wrong?
Well, the original one opened on 3rd Street, right by 3rd and Convention, right? In what year? It had to be a few years before 1959.
I think it was right after the war.
Yeah.
As I understand it.
Yeah. So, and that one was
44?
Was obviously still open in 1959, but... that location, of course, is a stone's throw from Baton Rouge High. Many people have wonderful memories of times at the Piccadilly. And that neighborhood is seeing a resurgence. It's a shame that the Piccadilly is not part of that. So what was it like Sunday when you went? You went in right during
About the same time you were there. About 2:30. Right. I figured they would be a line earlier, and that was kind of... pointless. And I'd been there the day before and gone Saturday. My mother-in-law was a Cancellosi, and her dad developed Westmoreland. They'd call and say, come on, meet us for lunch on Saturday. So we went over and going through the line, and I got the liver and onions and decided there was a lot else I'd like to have, and so we went back on Sunday.
Well, Piccadilly has struggled to stay alive in the changing environment. Cafeterias of this kind just aren't as viable as they once were. But this location was something special, and other than the pastime, someone also mentioned Don's. I think Don's on the airline probably opened after the Piccadilly in 59. But it... Fleur de Lis. How long's Fleur de Lis been there?
I think right after the war, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we need to have a list, perhaps in your column, of the oldest places to eat in Baton Rouge at one location. And another listener, as I always prone to mention, the Wiener Schnitzel.
Speaking of gourmet,
it's been there. You know, gourmet food. Yeah. When I enrolled at LSU in 1977, that's the only restaurant still standing at its location where it was at that time. Hugh at LSU. Hugh, good morning. Hugh? Michelle?
How are you? This is Hugh.
Yes. What's on your mind, Hugh?
Well, I just wanted to know if it was true, Smiley. I've been back about a week vacationing down here. And I don't know, but is it true that you're running for governor?
Who, me? Oh, I can. I'm an honest man.
Well, we had a gubernatorial aspirant in here a few moments ago in Nikki Papazoglikas. She received 21,885 votes in 2011, running against the incumbent, Bobby Jindal. Smiley might get even more votes than that. But we'll return with Smiley and Ben after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. We're talking about the demise of one of the institutions of Baton Rouge, the Westmoreland Piccadilly on the fringe of Catholic High School and across the street from Baton Rouge High School. And it is now gone as of Sunday, the final day, June 29th, 2014, after being open for 55 years. Smiley Anders from The Advocate, Ben Williams from LPB with us to talk about it, and Michelle Southern producing on short notice, very elegantly. Harry at Mid-City. Good morning, Harry. You're on with Ben and Smiley.
Hi, this is Barry in Mid-City.
Okay.
Smiley, you remember Buffington Mayor with beautiful long ties with all of the pins on them?
Oh, yeah, Buffy, sure.
Buffington, may he rest in peace, and I used to have coffee over at Piccadilly many, many times. And then we had a luncheon crowd from the temple that we would gather there for lunch and discussion. Really going to miss the place.
Yeah, it was a great place. Just kind of down home cooking. Not really anything. Well, I guess maybe the crawfish etouffee was there. The one dish you could call a gourmet dish, but the rest of it was just good stuff. You know?
Well, I really hope the staff will be placed okay, and they were wonderful ladies and guys that would always wait on us.
Yeah, well, I heard that Henry Gray is going to be at the Florida Street location, so we'll still have Henry's music to dine by.
Very good.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well,
thank you,
Jim.
Thank you, Barry, with a B. Stacy in South Baton Rouge. Stacy, you're on the air. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I just wanted to add, I've heard that Delpit's Chicken Shack is the oldest operating restaurant in Baton Rouge.
You know, Joe Delpit was on this show, and he said that, and it's been around longer than any other restaurant, but has it been at its current location? I don't know. Smiley?
I've seen wherever I saw that reported, maybe 225 or The Advocate, they specified that it was in the same place, but I don't know for
sure. Joe Delpit, great guy, and he and his family have stood the test of time, and he was on this show, and it's about time to get Joe back, if he'll come. He said one of his employees through the years was a fellow named H-Rap Brown, who, of course, became a revolutionary and born October 4th, 1943, same day as another Louisiana revolutionary, Buddy Romer. 297-5633, HB in Denham Springs. HB, good morning to you.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Smiley, you and I share a common deal in a strummer. You finished in 55, and I finished in 63. And the question I have for you is simply this. I remember the blue-collar workers riding their bicycles to work at Exxon and Ethel and all that. What do you think that Big Fuzz and Little Fuzz, if we could hear them speak today, would say of the changes from the Estrema 70805 zone to what it is today? Thank you, sir.
What about the...
Well, everything changes. I think it always remained a blue-collar school. You went from white students to black students, but I think the mission was always the same, to educate kids that came from families that didn't have a lot of money and to help them to get good jobs and maybe go on to college. And I don't think that ever changed.
Greg in Broadmoor. Good morning, Greg. You're on the air with Smiley and Ben Williams. Hi.
This is Gary. I'm a 70 Estrema graduate, ate at Westmoreland many times, but the world has changed. You can get more food for less money at other restaurants, and people went there instead of that. I did the same thing. So,
but can you get a balanced meal though?
Yeah, I mean, you can go to a place on Sherwood Forest Boulevard and get all you can eat for $9 or $10, $12. It's way less money. I mean,
I don't know.
I like the food over there. I like the guy playing the piano, but I mean,
I've had the dilly plate for a lot less than $12 at Piccadilly. So I don't know that it's a pricing issue, but for whatever reason, Piccadilly management decided that that one had seen better days, and it's unfortunate. I think the first time in 55 years Last time there wasn't a Piccadilly on Government Street, the Westmoreland Shopping Center. Earl Long was governor of Louisiana, and Dwight Eisenhower was president of the United States, and Paul Dietzel was the head football coach at LSU. That was 1959, the year that Billy Cannon made his Halloween run. People were dining at the Piccadilly.
And Earl used to eat there. He has a great recording that Brooks Reed made years ago where Earl says, "I eat at old Piccadilly. I don't go to no gourmet place in New Orleans, no Antoine's. I go to Piccadilly, good old Piccadilly."
Ben, how was the area around Piccadilly back in 1959 at that time? What was in that shopping center other than
Piccadilly? As best I remember, which as a five-year-old, I don't remember much. But it was A&P, which is where my mom shopped, and a Morgan and Lindsay, and Andrews, Rexall Drugs. I think Rosenfields was on the end. TikTok. There was a Con Turner in there at one point. I don't remember how far back it
was. Well into the 80s.
Yeah. So I don't. Other than that, it was. It's where we hung out. Yeah,
Smiley,
across the street.
Smiley probably bought a few suits there. At Con Turner.
I couldn't afford Con Turner. I couldn't afford A&P.
That's why you were eating a Piccadilly, right? Paul Anopoulosis. Paul, good morning. You're on the air. Hi, Paul.
Yeah. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Jim. Lafayette still has two Piccadillys. We're just counting the days before they shut their gates. But still great food, and like you said, it's a good place to get a good balanced meal. Really good, really good. I'm sorry to hear about the one closing in Baton Rouge. That's just my comment.
All right. Well, thank you, Paul. And there are Piccadillys remaining. There's one on Sherwood Forest. There's one on Essen that's been there since March of 1983. And then there's the one on Florida, which opened in the late 90s. And you say Henry Gray's moving down to Florida.
Yeah, that's what I heard. So he'll be we'll still get that blues without liver and onions.
But you can't recapture the history of that particular location.
No,
to think if the walls could talk, Smiley Anders.
Yeah, no kidding.
How many clandestine meetings were at Piccadilly in those boots?
And it was out on 3rd Street. That was where the lobbyists hung out. The legislators would come by. That in the Hunt Room at the Capitol House, where you could always find lobbyists.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Bryan, who I saw at Piccadilly at 2:30 on Sunday, he writes, "The front of the house was home to the original chicken shack that Thomas H. Delp had founded in 1935 on East Boulevard and Letchworth Street in Old South Baton Rouge." So Chicken Shack looks like, according to Bill Bryan, that it did move. So
Bill knows his history.
Bill knows his history. So Bill Arsenault mentioned Don's Seafood on the airline, and I that had to have opened, what, in the 60s?
At the time,
maybe?
The Belmont was...
Probably in the 60s,
after the war, I would think.
Yeah. But... long live the Piccadilly at Government Street, and I wonder what will go in there next.
Well, Catholic High has the land, I understand, so they've got some plans, I'm sure, for that whole strip. There's not much left there. Maybe a dollar store.
Well, and there's the Louisiana Key Academy. Louisiana Key Academy, which we featured on the show a few weeks ago, helping dyslexic children. But it's a shame that location has gone by the wayside, and there was almost no notice. So obviously some people, if they were out of town, they come back, they probably go in and, "What's going on here?" And it's gone. So, but I used to see Smiley there on a regular basis. And I think the only man I know of who was there on day one and at the end of the 55-year reign was Ben Williams. And Ben, you said your family... or your wife's family actually owned the building at one time.
Well, the whole shopping center, Westmoreland.
Yeah. And that shopping center back in the day, Smiley, next to what was happening downtown, it was where the action was, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As he said, Andrew's Drugstore was a hangout for kids in that area. Mm-hmm. And it was a booming shopping area.
I imagine when Johnny Rivers was going to high school, he was eating at the Piccadilly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
And thank you.
Hopefully, we'll talk about a happier thing next time we visit. And with us now is the fabulous author Jane Ann Phillips. Her latest work is Quiet Dell, Extraordinary, a mesmerizing blend of fact and fiction cloaked in shimmering language. That's the review from the Associated Press. Jane Ann Phillips is the professor of English, or is the distinguished professor of English and director of the MFA program at Rutgers University. She is a finalist, or has been a finalist, for the National Book Award, and she is back with another stirring novel. Chicago, 1935 is the setting. Good morning to you.
Hey, Jim. Hello, Baton Rouge.
Well, good to talk with you. Well, you write in a vivid way that few others do, and Chicago, 1931 is fertile territory for you to tell your tale. And the New York Times, in its review, or at least one of its reviews, says this book is a bit different from your previous works. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's different in that the story was already there. This book stays very close to the actual facts of how the Quiet Dell murders unfolded. And it has a history in my family and in my people, so to speak. My mother, at age 6 in 1931, held her own mother's hand and walked with hundreds of others down the dusty, crowded country road past what was called the Murder Garage, a building that Harry Powers had built specifically to cloak his deeds. And as they walked past, she told me of how she saw, you know, rows and rows of black cars parked as far as she could see, and they heard the crowd taking apart the building piece by piece for souvenirs. And, of course, that story really stayed with me, but it wasn't until 6 or 8 years ago that I began actually researching the case and coming to understand who the Eichers really were, this mother, this widow from Park Ridge, Illinois, with her three children, who were 14, 12, and 9, and the youngest daughter in particular, Annabelle, became a focal point for the book.
Well, the people who are of a certain age probably think America has never been as violent as it is today, and we do live in a violent society, but 1931 Chicago was a pretty wild place, wasn't it?
It was a wild place, although Asta Eicher, who was an upper-class immigrant from Denmark, lived in Park Ridge, which is a suburb that was very gentle, I think. I think they were a pretty cosseted family, but her own circumstances had turned pretty dark. Her husband had been killed 5 years before, and in Quiet Dell, the paternal grandmother who had lived with the family and somewhat protected them had also dies at Thanksgiving. And Asta begins receiving letters from a courtly gentleman who seems to want to do nothing but protect her and her children. The reader knows that she's about to lose her home, and she enters into this correspondence. As someone in Quiet Dell, as one of the characters says, people can be quite unlucky. And it was kind of a question of fate that she met up with this dark fate. And part of the reason I wrote Quiet Dell was to answer the dark story with a story that moved into other realms. I mean, there were questions about, you know, who this murderer was and where he came from, but also questions about human consciousness itself and those who intervene to protect people they might not even have known in life. Young reporter Emily Thornhill, who at 35 is not so young in 1931, but she's a professional journalist, happily unmarried. She becomes very invested in the story of the missing family, and particularly in finding out what happened to Annabelle. And she uncovers a number of mysteries in Quiet Dell. It's a kind of mixture of suspense and historical fiction, I suppose.
Well, Asta and her three children are dead, and Harry Powers is the catalyst and the person that is most vivid in this story, and this was a real person.
Oh, yes, all the characters, with the exception of very few invented ones, were real people. I mean, they lived 83 years ago, so that I invented their thoughts and perceptions and their relationships. I wanted the reader to really experience these children as alive and important, and that their lives not be defined by brevity. Annabelle, in fact, the 9-year-old child, remains in the narrative even after her death, which is a kind of, you know, questioning of the dimensions we live in and the idea that there may be thoughts and forces surrounding us that we're not always aware of.
What was it about Harry Powers that was so compelling that Asta fell sway to him?
Well, he was the kind of consummate actor and chameleon. He had a whole code of phrases that he actually used in his letters to women, and he was careful never to meet them until they'd agreed by letter to marry, and that seems astounding to us. But in 1931, it was a very different world. People were separated by distances. They wrote letters. Many of them took part in daily correspondences, and his letters were quite beautifully written. And Asta, when we learn her story in Quiet Dell, why she was particularly vulnerable, she'd had a difficult life, and she asked the question, you know, was it so unbelievable that a good man exists? And the reader follows her, you know, on this journey, and then through the discovery, Emily's discoveries, the trial, and a strange postscript that I discovered in researching the book that I needed to pull into the novel and make a part of the story.
Emily Thornhill, the journalist you mentioned at the time, Jane, she was one of the few women journalists in the Chicago press. She comes across as a heroic figure in this story. Tell us more about Emily.
Well, Emily serves as a kind of counterpart, in a way, to Powers' female victims. I mean, all of these women lived at the same time, but Emily was different for her time. She was much more like a contemporary woman, and because she had resources and a good education and was very independent, she wasn't held back, in a way, by the conventions of the time. I mean, the press really spun this story as a warning and lesson to women who might act on their own, who might take risks, who might write to a stranger, so that they sort of blamed the victim in the famous phrase, rather than thinking about how society might protect vulnerable women and children. I mean, it's interesting that even today, children and women who are unprotected are still fall victim to predators. And what is society's responsibility there? I mean, that's one of the questions that Quiet Dell sort of grapples with.
The book is Quiet Dell from Simon & Schuster, a novel from Jane Ann Phillips, who will be with us a bit longer, 297-5633 or inkstershow at wrkf.org. People Magazine says In Cold Blood meets Lovely Bones, but sexy. And Wall Street Journal says of the book, there is a glowing beauty to its brave, generous version of history. We shall return in 90 seconds with Jane Ann Phillips after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Michelle Southern is producing, and our guest for a while longer is Jane Ann Phillips. A bit later, another remarkable writer, Dean Koontz. Jane is the author of Lark and Termite, Motherkind, Shelter, Machine Dreams, and she has done very well with her latest book, now in paperback. It's called Quiet Dell from Simon & Schuster, Chicago, 1931, Asta Eicher, a lonely mother of three, desperate for money after the sudden death of her husband. And she begins to receive seductive letters from a chivalrous, elegant man named Harry Powers, who promises to cherish and protect her, ultimately to marry her and take care of her and her children. And within weeks, Asta and her three children are dead, and enter Emily Thornhill, one of the few female journalists in the Chicago press. And Emily goes to West Virginia to cover a murder trial. What happens there?
Well, Emily first goes to West Virginia as the family are actually being discovered in a shallow grave in the beautiful kind of rural road that was actually the cover photo of the hardback version of the book. So she's there when the family are exhumed, and she accompanies them in a hearse to Pittsburgh for the cremation and back to Chicago for the service. She then goes back to in December to West Virginia for the trial, but before that she makes a trip to Iowa, to the Midwest, to try to track down the origins of this man who calls himself Harry Powers. So there are lots of mysteries in Quiet Dell.
Now, you are a native of West Virginia. What compelled you to this story originally?
Well, my hometown was only about 10 miles from this tiny hamlet called Quiet Dell, which is really just a beautiful, at this point, a beautiful country road that runs along a stream. And, you know, all growing up, as we would pass the road on our way somewhere on the two-lane road that then went through the country, my mother would say, "There's the road to Quiet Dell," and she needed to say no more because she told me the story from the time I was about Annabelle Eicher's age, about 9 years old, of this otherworldly event that had happened when she was a child of six. So people in their 80s, you know, still remember this happening. But when I began to really enter the story through research, I came to know Asta Eicher's home very well in Park Ridge. The woman who lives there now became a friend. So the story has become very real to me. Things like the playhouse the children played in Park Ridge still stands. The mural Asta Eicher painted there for her children is still there. So the story is, it has amazing ramifications for us in our lives now. I mean, we sort of grapple with news of terrible things, and we wonder, when suffering seems reasonless, what is the meaning of, you know, terrible things that happen, and Quiet Dell delves into that. I mean, Emily Thornhill and several other characters are drawn together and form very deep relationships with one another in the act of protecting this family and seeking justice for them, and that act changes their lives going forward in ways they could not have expected or predicted. They become, in a way, living testimonials or memorials to the family, because the family becomes real to them, and the family has someone who will remember them and think of them, whereas before they simply had vanished, and that always seems wrong to me. It seems wrong that we pay so much attention to the perpetrators of violence and so little to the victims.
Well, the book is Quiet Dell, named one of the best books in 2013 by several media outlets, and it is in paperback from Jane Ann Phillips. We thank you for joining us today, Professor Phillips.
And thank you so much, Jim.
We look forward to a future conversation.
Oh, me too. Take care.
Take care. We're joined now by the remarkable Dean Koontz, American author. Novels are broadly described as suspense thrillers, but Dean also frequently incorporates elements of horror, science fiction, mystery, and satire. And his New York Times bestsellers have been plentiful. And he is back with a vengeance with The City. Good morning, Dean Koontz.
Good morning.
Nice to talk with you again. And you keep on doing it. Seems like we were talking
well,
just a
I
few
have
weeks
no other
ago.
Ability.
Yeah, well, you have sold what, over 400 million copies of your books. 400 million. That's more books than we have people in the United States, Dean. And after a while, you probably think, "My goodness, do I have another one in me?" But you're back in the city in the late 1960s through the eyes of Jonah. Now, tell me the name of the main character.
The main character is Jonah Ellington Basie Hines Eldridge Wilson Hampton Armstrong Kirk. His family is a family of musicians, and he was named after some of the greats of the big band era.
A musical prodigy.
He's a musical prodigy, yeah.
Yeah, in the city. And the city is a vivid place.
Well, I hope so. I've created what I call a universal city. Instead of setting it in the real world places that I usually do, this book, In Innocence, I just created a city of my own that reflects many cities and has sort of universal components so that I can do things that you can't do when you have to say stay absolutely true to the way the streets work and everything else. So Jonah lives in a city that could be several cities, his life unfolds there, and he gets to tell it from an adult voice that the man is 57, but talking about some amazing, wonderful, and disturbing things that happened to him when he was 8, 9, and 10 back in the 60s.
It encompasses a lifetime, but unfolds over three extraordinary, heart-racing years of tribulation and triumph, in which Jonah first grasps the electrifying power of music and art, of enduring friendship, and of everyday heroes. Jonah Kirk is the name of the exceptional singer, grandson of a formidable piano man and a musical prodigy, beginning to explore his own gifts. Certainly you have crafted a magnificent person in this book, In the City, and it is a time that is vivid with all kinds of beautiful settings. You can do it like few others, Dean Kuntz.
Well, it's I do it with passion. This is a story about not just a suspense novel, although I always want to have suspense in it, but also a novel in which we explore a family, and a pretty unique and fascinating one, and especially the relationship with between a boy and his mother. And his mother is a would-be singer. She is a singer. She's a good one, but she doesn't find it easy to make a living at it, and works part-time also at Woolworths in the lunch counter as a waitress. But it's a book about perseverance, about overcoming tragedy, and about focusing on optimism in life and getting to where you want and fulfilling your dreams. And all of that in the context of a story in which some very bad people are trying to do some very bad things to this family.
Now, the time, the late 1960s, that was a fertile time in this country. All kinds of things were happening. How does that time affect Jonah?
Well, of course, I lived through the 60s. I was getting out of high school in the mid-60s, and then on going on to college, and I've written about the period before, but not in a long time. And I went back to write about it and do refresh myself, go to the usual books and things of the period. And one thing that struck me is it was a very tumultuous time in the 60s, but no more tumultuous than our time. It's just that life is always tumultuous, I expect. But it was also a very time full of some really vivid characters and interesting moments. And it was kind of fun going back and getting into all of that again, and especially using big band music as a background. I found big band music in the 60s when I was in college, and fell in love with it, and it's been a lifelong love. And it was a great blessing to be able to write about some of these great figures in big band music and share with readers some of my enthusiasm about that, which I'm getting very good reaction on. People, I think, are interested in that. We see people like Michael Bublé and so forth coming back and sort of touching on the music of that period and reinterpreting it. So I think there's an interest in it.
Well, it is apparent you have an affinity for the music of that time, and the city is emblematic of the late 1960s. If you had to name a particular city, is there one that is most like the city from Dean Kuntz?
Oh, it's got a little bit of New York in it, and it's got a little bit of Chicago in it, and it's got a little bit of Philadelphia in it, and I just, because I'm inventing it, I always admired the mystery novels that were written by Ed McBain. They were called the 87th Precinct novels, and he wrote dozens and dozens of them, and he invented his own city for those books, and I always sort of envied that, because I thought, here is something that you can make it just as grittily real as anywhere, but it gives you a plastic fluidity that allows you to do things you can't do in other formats.
Do you remember the first time you went to New York?
Oh, yeah. And, when we were living in Pennsylvania, I used to go into New York all the time, and it was it's the first time or the first 100 times are always sort of the fascinating thing, especially to a kid who was raised in a town of 4,000 in the middle of a farm county. So New York was astonishing to me. And still is, except I don't travel very much anymore, so I don't get out of the West Coast.
No, you're too busy writing, and you're doing this from Southern California. So as we know, Dean has an exquisite imagination. But how do you keep those juices flowing? How do you keep doing it?
I don't know. It's just this book started as a short story, and I didn't see a novel in it, but suddenly I was at page 40 or 50, and I realized, whoops, this isn't going to be a short story. I think it's going to be a novel. So before I took that fully plunge, I sent like 30 pages to my publisher and editor to see, what do you think of this? And happily, they responded very strongly and said, can you get this finished so we can publish it in the summer of 2014? And then that was the bane of a writer is the deadline. But once I started this book, it's one of those that almost writes itself and you wonder where it comes from. It's what psychologists call a flow state. And when you finish it, it can be an exhilarating and also emotional experience to go through a book that just comes to you if it's being transmitted into your brain by some greater force than you.
You write every day, don't you?
Nearly every day. There's occasionally a day I don't get some writing in, but most days, yes, and at least five of those days, and more often six, I write from 7:30 in the morning until dinner time. And I love that because when I'm sitting here and writing about the imaginary world, it comes totally alive for me. You know, hour three or four, where if I was writing 2 hours a day, probably it would not seem so real to me.
Do you still get excited when you know you've written something that is right there with your best work?
You're never 100% sure something seems to be really working, but maybe it's not. And so for me, it's my wife's office is right next door to mine, and nobody ever sees, generally, and this was a rare case where I showed some early chapters to people, but normally I write the book, and it's only after it's finished that I let anyone see it. And my wife is first reader and my editor close behind. And when my wife, who is my toughest and fairest critic, comes into my office, as she did with The City, and said, I wouldn't change a word. This is your best book. It's kind of heartening. And, of course, I didn't believe her. I kept saying, what? There must be something wrong. And she finally had to tell me I was acting like an idiot to take her at her word. It's fine.
Well, it's a fine work. And if your wife says it's your best work, then it's your best work.
You never disagree with your wife on something like that.
Did you ask her what's second?
No, I just don't want to go there. Bask in the praise and don't worry about the...
Well, the name of the book is The City, and it starts, my name is Jonah Ellington Basie Hines Eldridge Wilson Hampton Armstrong Kirk. From as young as I can remember, I loved the city. Mine is a story of love reciprocated. And it's apparent that you love to write and people love to read what you write. And that has to give you great satisfaction no matter how many times you do it, Dean Kuntz.
Oh, absolutely. It's a wonderful feeling. When you do a signing or you speak, nobody comes up and says, I hate what you do, and spits on your shoes. So it's exhilarating when people like it.
Well, the Los Angeles Times says Kuntz has always had near Dickensian powers of description and an ability to yank us from one page to the next that few novelists can match, and you've done it again. And my guess is that you have another one coming sometime soon.
I'm writing the last of the Ab Thomas novels, St. Aud, right now, and when that one's done, it'll be another one.
Well, was reading about you, I said 400 million. The number's actually 450 million books in print from this man who has joined us this morning. Congratulations on what your wife says is your best work. Now out and about for the masses to consume, The City, from Dean Kuntz. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. And a note from Stephen Morey, who was with us yesterday. He wanted to clarify something he had said, and certainly I want to make sure we give him the opportunity. He said, Jim, I was listening to the show. I guess he was listening to the podcast at WRKF.org and realized that I had inadvertently said the film tax credit has helped create and sustain tens of thousands of jobs in Louisiana. I meant to say roughly 10,000 jobs, not tens of thousands. Okay, fair enough. Nicholas on Nicholson, Nicholas Carey Oak says, I was quite impressed with Stephen Morey. Very eloquent and good sense fellow. For those who have been critical of the Jindal administration, and at times probably justifiably so, I think Governor Jindal certainly deserves plaudits for hiring a fine man and a man who has produced as Economic Development Secretary. That's it for today. Please stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.